Blog Talk Radio.
And the collective wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank, and I am the host of this show. My guest this evening is friend and creative genius and survivor of many life challenges, Joel Wexler. Joel has written a play that he will tell us about tonight, as well as read some excerpts from the play. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Joel Wexler. Hello, Joel.
Hello, Kate. How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you this evening?
Well, the rain has stopped, and it's kind of like summer, so I'm pretty good.
It was quite the rain, wasn't it? Wow.
Yes, it was. It was kind of like Noah's Ark, I guess you might say.
Some sort of biblical, heroic, amazing survival story.
Yeah, well, you know, we had the ravish, but I guess that didn't happen.
Well,
or the rapture. It was called the rapture.
The rapture, right. Over the weekend, there was that incredible tornado, though, that took out a whole town in Missouri, and people were saying, well, maybe that was the rapture, but I don't think so.
No, not yet. My plan is to get to Broadway first.
Right, but we have to write our books and get to Broadway before the rapture comes.
There you go.
Well, I mean, I want you to tell us about your play, and I understand that you read or you performed it maybe this or you probably had a reading this weekend. So tell us about the play and tell us about the reading.
Well, first let me start with the fact that this play, it's called In Our Time, and it has undergone many transformations. It was first done more as a long lyrical poem. I'll read some parts of that a little later. In San Francisco at an AIDS conference as far back as 1995. And then I put it away for a while. The person that it's about is my deceased lover, Tim Meehan, who died of AIDS on February 10th, 1995, 16 years ago. And I decided while I was in San Francisco to write a play mainly about not only Tim, but about other good friends of mine who had caught the virus and died from it. And it was at an AIDS conference in San Francisco. You know, doctors and other people listened to it and gave me feedback. And then I kind of put it aside for many years. And recently, at the Universalist Unitarian Congregation in Montclair, I thought, why not do it, bring the change it. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, change it, bring it up to date, and see what happens. So with a lot of from the UU theater group, a lot of feedback, change this, add that, eliminate this, and all good feedback. It's kind of like almost like a collaboration between me and the members of the UU theater group. And I got to the point where I felt it was ready to be read. So this past Sunday, the 15th, it was read as a staged reading. I just come out at the end, which I'll tell you about later, but it was read as a staged reading. In other words, somebody played me. It's mainly about my journey with meeting Tim and going through good times, which Kate could talk about too, in San Francisco and Berkeley, from 1982 to 1995. The first act is about the good times before the AIDS virus hit, and the second act is about, is of course very sad because the AIDS virus got Tim, you know, at the age of 46, which is pretty young, I'd say.
Yeah.
And the actor who played me, nobody memorized lines. They did it as a stage reading.
Right.
They all were terrific. They all were really terrific. But the actor who played me, I told him at the end of the play, he played me better than I played me.
Right.
He was so good.
That is tremendous. I would love to have seen it. But, of course, I will see it again sometime.
Yeah, and I have a videotape and an audio tape so I can mail you that. And you can watch it or see it. Hear it, rather.
Yeah.
Anyway, should I read some scenes from it?
Now, I want you to. And then you had said that it had, first of all, been a lyrical poem.
Yeah, Jolene Delaney, even though some of the same material's in it, it was written first more like a lyrical poem for the San Francisco production way back in 95. But people encouraged me to change it and make it more into a play, more with dialogue, even though the first one had dialogue. It read more like a poem, and like I said, I could read you sections of that later on. But
yes, okay, So go ahead with the play. That would be terrific.
Okay. I'm going to read a few scenes, two, I think, comic scenes that were a favorite for the audience, and then one scene where I'm working with a client who has AIDS. I was a drama therapist in San Francisco and Berkeley, working with a client who has AIDS, and how I help him deal with his illness. But first, I'll read. It's hard to choose which scene to read, though. I'll read two scenes. One is a scene that took place in San Francisco a few years after I had met Tim. We were living together near Golden Gate Park, and he was out to work, and I was studying my drama therapy courses. And I had gone to the bathroom, and I lit some incense, and the incense fell on some toilet paper, and the house almost burnt down.
Oh, my God.
Do you remember that? Did I ever tell you about that?
We did discuss that.
Well, let me read you that scene.
It's only funny because you're still here, and even though we didn't think you were, but that's another story. Go ahead.
All right, let me find it. In the play, I make the fireman into a firewoman to put out the fire, just because the actor that was going to read it originally, he couldn't make it, so I thought this other actress was actually a young woman. She became the firewoman. So let me find it and read it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Let me see. Firewoman. It's hard, like I said, it's hard to choose scenes, but this is a short one. Okay. Am I loud enough here?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly.
Okay. Okay, here we go, the introduction to it. There was a time when Tim and I were living in San Francisco near Golden Gate Park when I nearly burnt the house down. I'll try not to laugh. It was quite amusing. I was scared I'd catch hell from Tim, but he came home and just put his arms around me, and he said, "Be careful with the incense. I'll never forget this scene." Okay, here's the scene. Oh, my God, the bathroom is burning. The incense must have fallen onto the toilet paper. I'd better call the fire department. All of a sudden, fire engines are heard, and a firewoman comes bursting into the apartment with a fire hose. And she says, and this really happened except to the fireman. Let me see what she said.
Well, they showed up fast.
What's that?
They showed up fast.
Yeah, they did. And she says, we have to chop down this door, otherwise the whole place will burn down. I say, do what you have to do. Tim, my partner, is going to kill me. What will our landlord say? The firewoman says, don't worry. We have everything under control. You'll be all right. It's just the bathroom. It will be done in no time. What started the fire? Well, I was burning incense, and the incense fell on the toilet paper. Firewoman says, accidents happen. We burn incense in our house, too. Joel says, are you married? Firewoman says, no, I live with my girlfriend. Remember, it's San Francisco.
Yes, definitely.
Joel says, oh, your girlfriend, huh? So, do you want a cup of coffee? Firewoman says, no, thanks. I have to get going. I have other jobs. Joel says, and I don't remember what I actually said this, but I said to the firewoman, were you around for the 1906 earthquake when all those fires started? The firewoman says, no, I wasn't around. Those fires occurred before my time. Were you around? Joel says, no, I wasn't around either. The firewoman says, next time when you light the incense, be careful because it could be worse. Joel says, I know. Thanks a lot. The firewoman says, well, have a good day. Good luck with your boyfriend. Goodbye. Joel says, and good luck with putting out fires.
Uh-huh.
End of scene. So that's one funny scene.
Yeah.
Should I read another
yeah,
funny one?
Keep going, yes.
Okay. Then there was a time when Tim and I were living in Berkeley, and my mother and sister were visiting, and I hadn't come out as a gay man yet to my mother, even though she saw me living in the same house with Tim. We had moved from San Francisco to Berkeley because Tim had inherited some money. And let me find this. This people found quite amusing. And this is mostly true what transpired.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My mother now is 96, and she believes it or not, in good health. Okay. Spotlight on Joel to introduce the scene. My mother loved Tim. When she first met him, she didn't know we were lovers. She didn't even know I was gay, although it was pretty clear to almost everyone else. My sister Elaine knew. As in many families, there were a lot of secrets, denials, fantasies. The point is, Tim was clearly my lover, and the following scene took place when Tim and I were living in Berkeley. It brings bringing out the entire truth to light. Hallelujah. My mother Lillian are having this conversation in the kitchen of the home in Berkeley. Okay. Mom, I have something to tell you. Mom says, are you sick? Do you have a cold? There's terrible weather in San Francisco. Joel says, no, it's nothing like that. My mother says, well, what is it? Are you getting tired of us? Tired of your sister and me being here in Berkeley? We'll leave if you want to. Joel says, please be quiet a moment. I have something to tell you. Okay. Well, you know, Tim and I sleep in separate bedrooms. Well, yes, of course. And when you and Elaine come, you're not visiting, we sleep together in the same bedroom. My mother says, oh, isn't that nice? Tim is a great guy. I say, I know, but we do more than just sleep in the same bedroom. I'll try not to laugh. Where did you hear this one? We do more than just sleep in the same bedroom. Then my mother says, more? What do you do? Joel says, we have sex, we make love. Okay, here goes, Mom. I'm gay. Tim is gay. We've been together for 6 years and we love each other. My mother said, well, how long have you been gay? I say, for a long time. My mother says, does your sister know about this? Yes, I told her years ago. She totally accepts it. She loves Tim just like you do, and she likes hanging around with my gay friends, like Michael and so forth. Michael is the guy that introduced me to Tim. My mother says, you mean Michael is gay too? My mother is kind of a little naive or something. Yes, he introduced me to Tim, and many of our friends are gay. You met them on his vacation. My mother says, you do have heterosexual friends, right? Joel says, of course I have straight friends. Straight like you and Dad and Elaine and Judy and Jala and Delaney. There you go. And my sister's straight, and we have many more straight friends. My mother says, so straights mingle with gays? Is that because this is San Francisco? I say, no, Mom, you're pretty smart. It's happening all over. More importantly, how do you feel about all this, particularly about me being gay and having Tim as a lover? Pause. My mother thinks for a minute. She starts to cry. What are you crying about? Well, Joel, I'll try to do her voice. Well, Joel, when you said you had something important to tell me, I thought you were going to tell me you're a dope addict.
Maybe she was disappointed.
She was thrilled that I wasn't a dope addict.
She was glad you weren't. Okay.
So I see. So you were afraid what I was going to tell you was that I was a dope addict? My mother says, and this I kind of made up based on other conversations, but I stuck it here. So you thought that I was a dope addict. That's right. And I don't know what your father would think about you being gay. I don't think he'd really understand it. See, my father, as you know, had died way back in the late 60s, before I came out to almost anybody. I don't know if he'd accept it. But this is what my mother did say to me. But I would have smoothed the way, and ultimately, I think, I'll never know for sure, he would have accepted you for who you are. We'll never know. He's been dead. Anyway, but he would worry about you because you would have nobody to take care of you in your old age. No wife, no girlfriend. And then I say, well, I would have told him I have Tim. Now here's the foreshadowing of what's going to happen in the second act. If Tim lived long enough to take care of me, well, obviously he didn't live long enough to take care of himself. Is Tim sick? See, at that time he wasn't sick. So I say, no, I know this is a lot to absorb in one day, but maybe we can go to my therapist, Sam. He said to me, after you tell your mother you're gay, he'd be open to meeting with all three of us, you, Elaine, and your mother. I'll talk to you about what you're feeling about this. So what do you think about going to the therapist? And then my mother said, this is a punchline, okay, but is your therapist gay too? I say, yes. And then my mother says, is everybody gay in this city? And Dawn says, what do you think? And my mother says, oh, I was just teasing. They hug and embrace. So that was another comedic scene, you might say. Did you know that story, Kate, that my mother thought I was going to tell her I was a dope addict?
No, I didn't know that at all. That is, must have been a surprising thing to hear.
Yeah, well, my mother's quite a character. She really loved him, and when he did die, several years later, she was very sad for him, of course, and for me, too.
Yes.
But the audience really enjoyed that scene because of my mother's comments.
Yes, it's sort of a surprising thing.
No, Mom, I'm not a dope addict. I guess being a dope addict is worse than being gay.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. From her perspective, I mean, yes.
I guess so. Now can I read a serious thing?
Please.
Well, when I moved to San Francisco, I studied psychology with a concentration in drama therapy. And I started working as a drama therapist, mainly as an adult chronic schizophrenic. I was very creative and got into drama therapy. They loved the acting out that you can do, the creativity. I think I've told you this, Kate. Actually, my schizophrenic clients were more into drama therapy than the average normal neurotic client, because the average normal neurotic is a little more inhibited.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the schizophrenic clients, they love to let loose. And drama therapy gives them a way to bring out their creativity and give them a chance to just to be. Anyway, after working with these chronic schizophrenics and other clients, when the mid-80s hit and AIDS became an issue, I did have clients who came to me, and all they really wanted to talk about was AIDS, either their friends getting AIDS or themselves getting AIDS. For example, I had one client who came to me one day and said, "You know, Joe, I don't know what to do. I've lost 100 people to AIDS, friends, acquaintances, mothers." They started crying. And as a therapist, you know, usually you try to probe into what was your childhood like and everything, but that seemed totally inappropriate. I mean, who gave a crap what his childhood was? He was suffering, grieving.
Right,
now,
exactly.
Now, this client I had, his name was Gary in real life, and he came to me, and the AIDS virus had progressed. He had been, at one time, a very handsome, tall, blonde, kind of Nordic type, had dated many people, and got caught the virus. So this is how this scene takes place. Let me find it. Basically, what I did with Gary is do some drama therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm looking for it. One minute. Okay, sorry about that, but here it goes. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
The client Gary comes in. "Hi, Joe. It's good to see you again. That last session with you was very powerful. You know, it's really hard for me to deal with this disease." I might cry. "I remember how I used to look, and now look at me. I hate this friggin' disease. Why me? Why all of us gays? What did we do? It was considered originally a gay disease, and there was even a theory that there was a conspiracy by the U.S. government to wipe out gays. Of course, we found out that wasn't it, but..." Joel says, "Nothing, absolutely nothing. You do not deserve this. Nobody does. And don't forget, no matter how you look now, you are a very beautiful person, and you have a lot of talent. Remember that shield you made in the office last week? Well, that shows me how creative you are. Did you bring the shield with you today? I have an idea how you can use it." "Yeah, I promise. But what good does it do me? It's not going to get me a date. Not the way I look. I want a date. I remember how easy it used to be before I turned into this freak." Joel asks Gary to work a little bit with his shield and see where it takes him. Gary's shield actually reveals a very complex drawing of different parts of himself. It was a very powerful symbol for him. He showed me how he might use the shield. Then Gary picks up the shield that he had made and says, "This shield is my force against AIDS. With it, I fight off deterioration, and it will help me to keep my spirits up. I use this shield against the dark forces of AIDS. Goodbye, AIDS. I will defeat you. You are evil, and I am strong. Goodbye, goodbye." Then, as a drama therapist, I enter the scene playing AIDS, and they say, "You will not defeat me. I am very strong. I will progress, and you will get worse." Gary says, "Yes, I know you, I will get worse, and you are very powerful. You will probably win out in the end. but I will put up a good fight. Then Gary stops and he puts the shield in his lap. And I say, well, Gary, how was it working? How was that working with the shield today? Gary says, oh, it felt good. I do feel a little more powerful. The therapist, me, says, good. Use the shield when you're feeling down. Maybe it will help you. Gary says, okay, I'll try. Joel says, you did really good work today, Gary. Keep fighting. I know it's hard, but you can do it. Gary says, okay. I think I'm going to call some friends and go out tonight. Because he had started isolating himself, you know?
Yes.
Because he didn't like the way he looked.
Yes.
Joel says, that's a good idea. Take care, Gary. See you next week. Good work. They hurt. And that's the end of that scene. Well,
did you work with a lot of HIV AIDS patients?
Yes, not as many as some other therapists, but I did. And Gary's been a therapy, not only because he was so sweet and had been, he showed me a picture of what he once looked like. If you think Rock Hudson was handsome before he got AIDS, Gary was a knockout.
Oh.
And he really deteriorated. And then when he was dying, he went home. He had been living, I think, in hospice or someplace, but his parents took him home. And his parents remembered that I had worked with Gary and invited me over to the house basically to watch Gary die. And I was so touched by his parents inviting me over. And I told them, they knew about the shield, and they said to me, you really helped him during a difficult time. And then I don't think I was there at the point of his death, but it just, I mean, tore me up. Not because he was handsome, even though what the hell, that didn't hurt. But just because he had died much too young.
Yes, yes.
So that scene had the audience that was listening to it last Sunday, that had them in tears. As a matter of fact, one woman came up and said, you know, I really cried when your lover Tim died, when Gary died. And the reason I cried is because I could relate to it. I just lost one of my sons. So what can I say to her? And she said, thank you so much for showing this, because we all die. And you were on the front lines dealing with deaths in San Francisco and Berkeley, because that's where the San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, that's where it first hit. And our esteemed president, Ronald Reagan, who was, Rock Hudson's buddy, well, kind of buddy, didn't even use the AIDS word for 8 years, whereas Rock Hudson's real buddy, Elizabeth Taylor, went to his bedside. She didn't give a shit that he had AIDS. She loved him. They had worked together in the movie Giant. You remember Giant?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she saw that he was dying. And this great actress who didn't have to do shit, she started a whole organization to help fight AIDS, gave a lot of money, and before she died recently, a couple of years ago, she had been given the Humanitarian Award. I mean, not only was she winning Academy Awards for her performances as an actress, she was really working on helping to fight AIDS before it was popular in Hollywood to give money. And at the beginning of my play, I quote her, actually, because I found a quote by her. Can I read it?
Yes.
She says, Elizabeth Taylor, well, she said she's no longer with it. Nobody asked for this disease. Nobody deserves it. We are all as innocent as babes in the eyes of God. And I think that's beautiful. And, you know, who gives a shit that she had 8 husbands?
I don't.
No. And
that makes her more, that actually makes her more interesting.
Oh, exactly. Everybody said that, yes, she was great as an actress and had some wonderful roles, and she had self-suffered. She had alcohol abuse for a while and went through many operations. But I think but you'll also be remembered as a great humanitarian.
Now, I want to clarify something about Elizabeth Taylor, and that is that she became involved in the humanitarian effort with the HIV/AIDS stuff even before Rock Hudson, I understand. So that she, I had heard that. Somebody, in fact, my friend, the astrologer, Sheila, is really an Elizabeth Taylor fan, and she's kind of up on this kind of stuff, and she said that she was involved in helping in that capacity even before Rock Hudson, which I found to be interesting.
Oh, that's very, I didn't know that. I'm not surprised, though, that she would do that.
No, it's like she was attuned into it, and then when Rock Hudson had the disease, she was right there, you know, right there for him, knowing more about it probably than most people at the time.
She did at the time, right?
Yes.
And she continued even after they started doing research and discovering ways to help curb the virus a little bit. She continued to the end of her life to give support. She was so rich, she continued to give support to the AIDS. She actually started this. She, with Dr. Matilda Krim, started this organization called AMFAR, which I think stands for American. I'm not sure what it stands for, but it has something to do with AIDS. So she...
Yes.
So Elizabeth Taylor is not only loved by gays and everybody because of her acting ability. And by the way, she said her favorite role was when she wasn't beautiful or anything. She said her favorite role was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I thought she did great in that thing. Yeah, that was a great movie.
She won the Academy Award for that. She didn't give a shit how she looked in that. She played that to the hilt.
I know. My gosh, it's so terrifying. It's like a real psychological drama, and they do it well. The two of them, Richard Burton does it well, and she does it well, because they understood people. They understood that people can act like that, and not only did they understand that, but they acted it out really well. It is terrifying to think. To be in that head, you know, of just lashing out and alcoholism and hate. Well, they really did a great job, though. And you know they're nothing like that. Although their relationship was a little heated, but they weren't like that in any way.
No, they were acting, that's for sure. But
they were totally
they really
acting,
got
yeah.
into it.
That's right.
Anyway, let
Go
me
ahead.
Read you. At the end of the play, after Tim dies, I could read that scene, but instead what I'll do, I got up after all the actors, they eulogized Tim. I could read some of those, okay?
Sure,
after
go
Tim
ahead.
Dies, there was a memorial service. So I had each of the actors get up and say something about Tim. I'll read you just a few of them.
Okay.
Let me see here. This was a device that was used in the play, which I'll talk about later, a play called The Shadow Box, where all the actors come and face the audience and they say things. So this is what people said about Tim. I won't read everything, but Tim was the most mature and interesting adult I ever met. And actually a person at Tim's real memorial service said that. Another person said, we will all miss Tim. He was a very special person and will always be in our hearts. Another one, we will always remember Tim's wit and warmth. Another one, Tim passed over from this physical play on February 10th, 1995, a victim of AIDS. Tim was a remarkable and extraordinary person. Another actor says, Tim was a licensed clinical social worker with the Department of Mental Health for Alameda County. Previously, he worked in forensics, that means working with heart criminals that commit terrible crimes. He worked in forensics for the state of California. We will remember a warm, dynamic man who loved to tell stories. He approached his work with gusto, whether chairing a state conference, working on an AIDS committee, or advocating for the client. Then here's something about your life, this case, something about the dog Chaucer. Remember Chaucer?
Chaucer.
Yeah. Michael, our friend Michael, who saw Tim die. I happened to be in San Francisco, but he had put Chaucer in bed with Tim while he was dying. So let's see. Where is this one? Oh, I thought there was something about the dog. Tim left his work in forensics. He was not intimidated by his clients. A quote, Tim was definitely like lightning, and how often does lightning strike in the same place, illuminate the same face with eyes full of him, seeing him in a crowded room for the first time, surrounded by seemingly gray, shadowy people. Tim was lightning. Where's the one about the dog? I guess not. I thought there was one about the dog, but no.
Well, I'm sure there is. It's just not jumping out at you.
No. So can I read? So the play ends with Brian, who played Tim, saying, "Goodbye, everyone. I hope to see you again. Love to you all." And before that, Vince, who played me, says, "Tim came into the light. When I first met Tim, I thought he was illuminated by light. But really, what he was, it was really a car, you know, the reflection of a car. I was working in a restaurant when I met Tim, and it was really a car going by, but I thought Tim was illuminated by light. So I say, well, Vincent, Tim came into the light and touched my heart the very first time I saw him. He was wearing a red shirt, black dress, and immediately I knew it was him, my soulmate." And then the play ends, and they play, I haven't played two Bette Midler songs. One, The Rose, which I love, and the other one called The Story of Love, which I won't sing, but you could get it on a CD with Bette Midler's, you know, greatest hits. And Tim and I love Bette Midler. Anyway, should I read what happened after Tim died?
Yes.
Okay, so the play is finished, and I get up, and I say, "And so Tim died of AIDS on the evening of February 10th, 1995. I received a lot of support from friends, relatives. I guess you and Delaney and Jala knew about it, too. I'm sure you did. Anyway, he was gone. Then I got clinically depressed soon after. I couldn't work, couldn't pay the bills, lost pleasure in things, didn't laugh anymore. I had to leave the Bay Area, San Francisco, and Berkeley." Now, your listeners don't know this, but you do. "I went to live with my sister in New Jersey for a while. That didn't work out, so I had many hospitalizations. Tried very many different meds, saw many different psychiatrists and psychotherapists, and now finally, after 15 years of hell, I emerged about 2.5 years ago from my depression and started to become more involved in life again. I contacted old friends," well, you know that, "made new friends, particularly here at the UU, began writing again, laughing again, appeared last year in the UU Theater Group production of The Dining Room, which was a lot of fun. In other words, I came back into life. I don't know why. Maybe Tim was telling me it's time, and why don't you write a play about us? So I did. I started writing, and it all came back to me. I would laugh hysterically when I remembered some of those incidents, like the fire scene and the Gay Day Parade, and then I would cry because he's gone. But anyway, the point is that this experience of writing this play and presenting this play to you and reading it tonight even, has become cathartic. I feel in some strange way Tim is in me and encouraged me to tell the story and is actually here tonight saying, right on. The truth is, Tim walked...
Go ahead.
The truth is, Tim walked into the light in 1982. The light is still there and will always be there with me. And so I think of my AIDS client, Gary, many, many, many years ago, who made a shield in my office to protect him and empower him against AIDS. And now I pick up that shield that he left me. Actually, his parents had it. It's all a gift, I say. It's all a gift. Relationships, plays, Tim, and mostly a gift for me to watch this brilliant cast present so brilliantly and accurately the story of Tim and my life to you. Let's hear it for the actors and actresses. And then the audience applauded, and I bowed with them.
Oh, that is so cool.
I know, and then...
Congratulations. It's wonderful.
And then we had a question, comments for the author, and everybody, nobody said change this, change that. People came up to me and said, it's a beautiful play. You should try to have it done somewhere else. So I just got tremendous validation, and the cast was wonderful. They only rehearsed this really just one time before they did it, because they didn't have to memorize lines. And what they praised me for is that the fact that I took the time to do it over and over and over and revise and revise and revise. And your brother and everybody who writes probably knows this. Writing is all about revision. Even the great writers, Tennessee Williams, whatever, the poet laureate, I can't remember. Oh, Toni Morrison, she was interviewed. They asked her about the writing process, and she said, writing is revision, 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 until you get it right.
Yes. That is so true.
Yeah, I know. If you write yourself, you realize, I mean, the first time you might like it, but then people say, you know, you should do this, you should do that. And I think you have to be open to it, because... Because they're giving you ideas really out of love to make the piece even better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
So it's a total process, wasn't it, to write that? And it was personal, but I think you probably went beyond the personal as you...
What do you mean?
Like it had much more to do... It was larger than you and larger than... your experiences with Tim and your friends, I think.
Yes, exactly. What I wanted to happen is to have people identify with it, even if they're not gay, even if they're maybe to AIDS. That it's a play about loving and losing, that you love someone and then they die. And we all have that experience, obviously.
Right.
Let me see if I can find the original one that was read in San Francisco. My house is such a mess. You know, I recently moved. And
you just moved in. Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, on Sunday. You want to come and help me clean the mess?
Well, we are coming to New Jersey on the 20th of July, but I don't know if it's near you or not. East Rutherford?
Oh, yes, East Rutherford. I used to teach at Fairleigh Dickinson in East Rutherford.
Okay,
It's 15 minutes from where I live.
Oh, cool. Oh, good, good. So we'll talk about that later. Go ahead. Go do your thing there.
Let me see if I can find that script. That was an earlier script. Let's see. It's somewhere in this mess.
I'd like to hear the lyrical poem,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes. Actually, John and Delaney have a copy. Let's see. That's not it. Bear with me a minute.
Delaney is in the chat room, by the way.
What was that?
Delaney is in the chat room. We have a chat room that goes with Blog Talk Radio. His name, I have a feeling that the way it works is that he put it on and he's doing, you know, listening and multitasking. That's how I envision him right now. I envision him multitasking. He's listening to what we're saying, and then he's, you know, going around doing something in the room.
Well, I'll call him and John later and just get their feedback.
Okay.
Let me find the original poetic one.
Please do. I'd love to hear that.
I'll read you part of it.
At least part of it. I'm sure it's a very long poem. And
no,
we have about 15 minutes, believe it or not, 15 minutes left on the program. But, yes,
okay,
by
I'll
all means, read some of it. Yeah.
Okay, I'll find it. Hold on.
Yeah, when you move like that, even if you don't move, it's hard to find anything. Let's face it, everybody has problems finding things. That's my experience anyway. And while Joel looks for the prayer, the poem, I want to mention that Joel already did say, I'm just going to explain this, Joel, that yes, he did disappear for 15 years, and we really did think that he had died. And I had a horrible feeling that he had died of AIDS. And when he resurfaced, it was the weekend right after I had seen the movie Milk, played by Sean Penn. And I was kind of reliving our San Francisco experience because I was there in 1980, and we did a lot of walking around, and all that stuff was going on with people, the bathhouses, and people just in the beginning of the epidemic. And so I just had this horrible feeling that you had passed on because of the virus. And when you resurfaced right after that weekend, I don't think I've ever been the same since. Oh, my gosh. What a life. It's all good. Just to say that I'm hoping to get the prayer blog published, and I'm working on suddenly something has fallen into my lap that I am going to try to submit a manuscript by, I think it's the end of June. So anybody listening or listening in the future, please send me good vibrations. I hate to keep doing this and have nothing come of it. You know what I mean? It's
stay with me. Give me another 3 minutes. I'll find it.
Oh, sure. I'm just bullshitting.
Bullshitting.
Sorry.
That's always good.
It is always good. So go ahead and look for it.
Just I'll find it. I know I will.
I know you will too. So I'm taking what is called a transformational author's class. And the whole idea is a lot of people are taking this class, but they don't have, it seems to me that they don't have a manuscript, and I don't have a manuscript either. So but I have my prayers, and they're all there. I think I have 500 prayers by now. A lot of them may not be suitable, but I mean, not a whole lot of them. But I think a lot of them are, maybe even 250 of them are suitable for a transformation of the people who read it. So I will be working on that. I will be focusing on that as well as working full time and wrestling with the computer system at work, which isn't really a problem for me, but everybody there is having a problem with it. Believe it or not, it's very, very frightening to people.
I found it, Kate.
Okay, cool.
Okay, I'll read the end of it. I'll read the beginning of it.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll read the beginning and the end.
Okay.
Actually, Delaney, I think you might even have a copy. 1 minute.
You said that you had at least sent it to them, or maybe when you went there, you brought a copy or something.
Yeah, I brought it to them. And
yes.
Jala was in the play. I have a character, a goddess named Persephone in the play, all dressed in white, and Jala wanted to play her. And maybe she will.
So is there somebody there in the play called Persephone?
Yeah, in my original play, there's somebody called Persephone, the goddess Persephone.
Oh, my God, I cannot believe it. That's another story. We had an owl here by the name of Persephone, who was the most charismatic animal, creature, beast that I had ever met. She lived in the barn, and we would take her mice, and we would stand there, and she'd swoop down and grab the mouse right out of the pocket, no matter whatever pocket you happened to have the mouse in, she'd know exactly where it was and grab it out of your pocket. She'd fly back to the beam of the barn and look down and say thank you. You could see her say thank you, thank you, thank you, and then she'd eat the mouse. It was so absolutely cool.
That's
so go cool. ahead, read it.
Okay, I'll read the beginning. The play, I called it In Our Time also. I might change the title, but for now it'll go. The play opens in a very lush garden. As the narrator indicates on page 8, the scene changes from a garden to a white room looking out into a courtyard. From there it goes to the court, back to the meadow, and finally back to the garden at the end. And here's how it begins. See, it's much more poetic. The narrator says, "This is the country of young, living dead men. Bring around a rosy, a pocket full of poesy, ashes, ashes, all fall down. This is the land of the young, old men, brought here to die, sagging skin, hollow eyes, straggling hair, their summer, their fall, not dying in 75, 85, and 90, and 95, but at 25, 35, and 45. One of the participants says, "Leave us alone. We were brought here to dance, half-dead men, to dance in this lushness, the bright green hurting our eyes. Ashes, ashes, all fall down." And then it goes on and on. And then there's a section where Tim enters the garden. Because the narrator and Persephone bring different characters to me. And one of them is Tim. I'll read that one, okay?
Yes.
Oh, Gary is one of the ones that enters, too, and I use the shield in this play, too. Persephone says, "I will bring you Tim." What did you say? "The man you love, the man who died. Tell him about your feelings. Tell him about your grief. Here he comes." And then I have this long speech. "I remember you, Tim, in motion in that bright red silk shirt." This actually is true. You wore to the outdoor wedding in San Luis Obispo a few weeks after we had met. It was summer, July or August, and you know Southern California is hot as hell down at that time.
Oh my God!
And you were there at the wedding, all bright like a butterfly, gliding from table to table, flitting around, more animated than the bride herself. Introducing yourself to people you didn't even know. You seem to have more life than the bride. Anyway, you were better to look at than the bride, with your red shirt and your loose-fitting pants and your beautiful, soft, black beard. See, it's more like poetry. So there you were, laughing and making small talk, getting people, doing what you did best, you laughing and helping people out. They seem to want to be with you. You naturally drew people to your sphere of influence with your smile and your gestures, and you grabbed center stage from the bride." Tim says, "I didn't mean to do it. I didn't even know I was doing it. I was just doing what I did best in those days, talking with strangers, making small talk, getting them to pay attention to me." Joel says, then this goes into something that I included in the next version of play. "Were you always like that? Were you like that as a child, being hauled around from country to country, from state to state, an army brat?" And this is a true story. When Tim was 5 years old, his father was in the military and took him to, he and the mother, Germany was undergoing reconstruction, and the father was there, and they took him to Auschwitz, 5-year-old kid to Auschwitz. So I'm saying, well, anyway, I'm saying, and there you were, the Auschwitz story. What was it like for you to be in Auschwitz? Oh, I don't know, Joel. I was only 5 years old. I didn't understand what was going on. I knew it was a place of evil. I knew it was so silent. I had never heard silence like that before. Why did my parents take me? I don't know. Maybe they wanted me to see reality, even though I was only 5 and I didn't understand it. And then, when he was 10 years old, they returned to the South. Tim was from the South, from North Carolina. And this is very funny. Tim is a 10-year-old boy. He wanted to go to a water fountain to drink some water. So he goes to the wrong fountain. He goes to the fountain that's marked for colored only. You know they used to have that?
Yes, yes.
And what Tim, he was so cute, 10 years old, he thinks colored water is going to come out of that fountain. And he was looking forward to drink colored water. Because why not a 10-year-old boy or girl would love to have some colored water? But, of course, the colored water doesn't come out. His parents instead come out, and they say, what are you doing drinking out of that fountain? That's for colored only. And Tim says, what are you talking about? I don't understand, Mommy, Daddy. Well, this is the South, and that's the law. You got to drink out of the clear fountain. I don't want to drink out of the clear fountain. That's no fun. So he goes back into the restaurant, and all the pasty-faced Southern bigots are looking at Tim's parents and saying, what are you, don't you raise this child right? Don't you tell him he can't drink out of that fountain? And Tim starts to cry, and he says, I want to get the hell out of here. I want to drink colored water. Well, of course, the parents say, we got to leave. You have to drink out of that other fountain. I don't want to drink out of that other fountain. Okay, we'll take you away. So they took him away. And then I go back to, so there I am in San Luis Obispo on a bright, warm, sunny day in 1982, knowing nothing about AIDS, having no thought to look into a crystal ball and see my own death coming. As I flit around pouring champagne in glass after glass, did I think that some of these people receiving the light, yellow, bubbly champagne might, if they saw me at the age of 10 drinking from that fountain, they might have gasped just as those pasty-faced people did in 1958. It doesn't matter now. Here in San Luis Obispo, 24 years later, it's almost over. And I'm watching you pull this off, I'm saying, this energy, and I think, that's why I love Tim. He's so confident, so sure of who he is, so easy to train. So, the bell of the ball. And yes, there was a touch of envy. Why can't I be like him? But mostly there was love and pride that this man in the bright red shirt who had entered my life, and this is another scene, and the psychic Francesca McCartney in Sausalito said in 1985, this isn't the first time he has entered your life, Joel. This is crazy. You were brothers in the Crusades and husband and wife in the early 19th century. And the question is, what will we be to each other the next time around? Will I remember in some profound, mysterious way the man, the butterfly, and the red silk shirt? I think I will. A moment of recognition, a spot of red, and we will be to each other finally what we've always been, what we have always tried to be in all our lifetime, friends.
Yeah.
So, you see, that's more like a poem. And actually, that's
yes.
what I read at Tim's memorial service.
Mm-hmm. You have a karmic link with him. And he's also communicating with you right now.
Oh, I think so. The other night, a friend of mine took me to see the Gypsy Kings, this Brazilian group that Tim and I saw in San Francisco, in Berkeley, now,
uh-huh.
Outdoor. They're still playing their music, everybody dancing. And this sounds crazy, Kate. I mean, I'm 72 years old, and I was dancing, and I thought Tim was there with me.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. He was with you.
I guess he was. He was saying, get up and dance, you old man.
Right on. Well, this is the end of the show.
Well, can I read the last line of the
poem? Yeah, go ahead. Go read it. Please do.
I will. I can't find it. We'll have to save it. Basically, the last line of the original play is all the actors come forward and they say, we should have had more time. We died too young. We died at 25, 35, 45. Come dance with us. Don't leave us alone. Don't forget people who have AIDS. Give generously. Love us in our time.
Yeah.
Are you there?
Yeah, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. So what happens now?
What do you mean? Exactly.
I mean,
Show over yet? Is the show over? Yes.
what do I do?
Well, we'll say goodbye, and like I said, we're gonna come to East Rutherford in July, and we would love to see you July the 20th. So put July the 20th on your calendar.
You just coming for that weekend?
We're going to come for the weekend. And there's a Darshan, an Indian woman is going to be in East Rutherford who is the reincarnation of the Divine Mother. And I think of Mother Mary. And she's when she touches you, you are blessed. And I think that there's going to be thousands of people there. I'm not quite sure how it's going to work. But we're going to be there. And I'll let you know more about it when the time comes. We better make reservations, that's all I can say. At the Sheraton there in East Rutherford.
Oh, yeah, East Rutherford is where when I taught at Fairley Dickinson, it was in Rutherford, which is right next door to East Rutherford. So basically, I'm going to be 15 minutes away from where you are.
Well, that's really cool because then we can hang out and you can meet Ulysses because we're going to stay at a place where Ulysses can stay. and I think it's, as far as I'm concerned, touching Ulysses is better than touching any saint. But anyway.
I'm sure that it is. And maybe I'm going to talk to Delaney later. Maybe I could bring this play to Norfolk, Virginia.
Oh, my gosh. I think you should. It sounds like those people really performed it beautifully the other day.
Oh, they did. They did. There's a therapist in the play, and my therapist was there, and he came up to Jack with my therapist, and he said, if you want to become a therapist, you got it. Because he plays a therapist just like not a stereotype, but just like a therapist might play it.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack may have another career lined up.
Well, thank you, Joel.
You're welcome.
Thank you for being here, and I always enjoy having you on the show, and It's always just fun to have. I mean, at least we've talked a lot of times, and it's fun to have you on the show. But it'll be really great to see you in person. So I'm looking forward to that.
Oh yes, it'll be great for me to see Ulysses and your husband, of course.
Yes, and Ulysses.
And Ulysses. And maybe I'll put Ulysses in my next play.
Oh my God, the miracle dog.
Yeah,
absolutely.
There we go. We could do
it. Okay, dear.
Why don't we do it?
Go ahead.
Take care. I'll talk to you. And I'll call Delaney and John later.
Okay, I love you.
Bye. Love you too. Take care, Kate.
Take care. Happy birthday. And I'm going to play music for mother and child.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.